The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is That's Halef. For the next half hour, I'll be reading excerpts of funny stories, quotes, and other anecdotes from various sources that we hope will add a few chuckles to your day. It's finally that time of year where the extremely hot days are beginning to, sometimes, make way for slightly cooler temperatures. The leaves are beginning their transition to fall colors. And speaking of beginnings, okay, I know, a bit of a stretch in true Tal fashion, but work with me here. We have the origin story for author and comedian Sophie Santos. Today, we have the preface and first chapter from her book, The One You Want to Marry, and Other Identities I've Had, a memoir, copyright 2021. Fair warning, everyone, there may be some spoilers about Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the Tooth Fairy. Listener discretion is advised. And before we start with the preface, author's note. Some names and details have been changed, but the story itself is true. Cross my heart and hope to die, stick a needle in my eye. Preface. I was a late bloomer. Not physically. Those awkward melons came in too early for my liking. In fact, I had hoped they'd never make an appearance. But emotionally, I was a step behind. On second thought, two steps behind. Let's kick it back to December 26, 2004. I had just crashed my new moped while going full motocross madness down our gravel driveway. I had begged my mom and stepdad for a 250cc dirt bike, but instead, Santa delivered a dinky, bright red Scoot and Go. It was a present I did not deserve. And yet it did not live up to what I wanted. I still rode that electric scooter like the dirt bike I'd longed for, and I took off like a bat out of hell, which is not something I recommend. On my first ride down the driveway, I went full throttle, lost control, crashed into our neighbor's pristine fence, and shattered the scooter's headlight. Only 5 minutes in, and I had ruined my Christmas present. I hobbled into the garage, where my stepdad, Buck, was puffing on a Swisher Sweet. "You did some damage, kid," he drawled with a shrug. "Don't worry. Go talk to your mom. I have no idea where she got that thing." That didn't make sense. It didn't make sense because my mom hadn't gotten me the scooter. Santa had. I was 13 years old. Buck's words stunned me more than the initial crash. I let out a guttural, "Mom!" and raced inside the house. "What is it, sweet thing?" she asked. She was lounging on the living room couch in the perfect reading position, at an angle of repose that meant, "I'm relaxing, honey." "Buck," I said with a hard K, "told me to ask you where you got my moped, but Santa got it for me. Why would he say such blasphemous words?" Mom put down The Four Agreements, a book that was on her coffee table for more than 50% of my childhood. She folded her reading glasses and took in the skin dangling from my chin. "Also, I might have wrecked the moped." "I think we need to talk," she sweetly drawled. My mom's voice sounds like what I imagine the liquor Southern Comfort sounds like. It's comforting, sweet, but right when you get too comfortable, it'll bite you in the butt to remind you it's in charge. That day was a taste of the comfort. I thought she might be about to break it to me that Santa had cancer. "I mean, Santa's real," I scoffed. Her hazel eyes looked at me squarely in my big brown eyes. "I'm sorry, honey. He's not." My mouth opened, and I froze. I would have preferred him to have cancer. Every memory I had of Santa Claus flooded to the front of my brain, like a bad trip through Willy Wonka's tunnel of terror, floating down the colorful river on the never-ending haunted gondola ride, seeing flashes of the presents my parents had given me. The carrots half-eaten by the reindeer, the oddly cropped selfies of his white-as-snow beard he'd left behind. Was I supposed to believe the reindeer hoofprints on the steps were fake, too? I stood there with my well-developed rack, eyes welling up with tears, spinning out faster than my scooter. I tried to give my best Detective Olivia Benson, swiping away the tears as they fell. "And the Easter Bunny?" I croaked. "Just me," she said with a half-smile. "I'm only going to ask you this once. What about the Tooth Fairy?" She confessed. "I have all your teeth hidden around the house." No further questions. I'm not, well, the most observant person, even to this day. My girlfriend hides my Christmas presents in plain sight, confident that I won't notice them. There is likely a present from her sitting on my desk right now, with my name plastered on it, accompanied by a big, blinking neon sign that reads, "The present wrapped in bright orange is for Sophie." And yet, nothing. Truly amazing. But a house full of children's teeth seemed a damning secret to keep. I was gutted. I should have you arrested. I thought of all those times I'd gone back to my class after the holiday break, confidently standing up for Mr. Claus's existence. I'd take my seat at a desk in the front row and whip my head around to face the other children. "Of course Santa is real. How else do you explain this?" I'd pull out a photograph from my JanSport backpack to reveal a close-up, yet out-of-focus shot of Santa's eyes and beard with a tiny crumb tucked into the hair. The other children sat in what I'd assumed was stunned silence. I turned back in my seat toward the board, smiling like I'd won. Back with my mom, I took a strangled breath. My parents had led me right out in front of a firing squad, believing I was invincible. My mom's words echoed in my head. "We took a picture of one of the Santa figurines, honey." Mom collected Santas of the world from Hallmark and Cracker Barrel, a new one every year. I had the privilege of helping her place them all around the house each Christmas. There was a Brazilian Santa and an Irish Santa. I had a feeling that this particular photo was from Cracker Barrel's Caribbean Santa. "Why would you lie to me?" I hissed, silently drumming up the worst word I could call my backstabbing mother, turd. "Your dad and I wanted to give you the best Christmas possible. It was a fun game for us. We really enjoyed playing Santa." A game. Interesting. I hadn't realized my dignity was something to play with. But there we had it. It was a game. And the game was now officially over. I lunged into her arms, curled up on the couch, and wept, tears sliding down into my cleavage. Christmas would be changed forever. That was the first time I realized I was a late bloomer, but it wouldn't be the last. Years later, I was sitting across from my retired Lieutenant Colonel Dad at a strip mall Mexican restaurant. He had taken me to lunch on my break from rehearsing for one of the spring college plays, The Government Inspector. I was in the stupid The Government Inspector because I was robbed and didn't get cast as Marine in Rent. I was still very much working through it. I had ordered a chimichanga, the perfect entree for stuffing face to avoid parental questions. Our conversation started with the usual college catch-up. How's class? How's your house? How's that friend who you haven't mentioned in years, but I'm going to bring her up because that's all I really know about your social life? Then, so, kiddo, you got a boyfriend? No, I said, with a huge wad of chimichanga tucked into my cheek. My dad cut a piece of his own chimichanga and placed it sharply into his mouth. Please don't ask me if I have a girlfriend. Please don't ask me if I have a girlfriend. Please don't ask me if I have a girlfriend, I chanted in my mind, hoping he would hear my plea. It's not that he had asked me the question in the past, but at that moment I did have a girlfriend, and I knew I wouldn't be able to lie. Without missing a beat, he said, "You got a girlfriend?" Boom! Just like that, my casual avoid-everything lunch had turned into a high-stakes interrogation. "Okay, sir, you can put away the warfare tactic." I worried my dad was about to start waterboarding me about these women I was allegedly dating. No, I said, taking another whopping bite of chimichanga, trying not to choke. All right. He sat there as I avoided eye contact with him. Mind-numbing silence. I chewed for what felt like 2 hours. Is this really how long it takes to break down a flour tortilla? Tossed back some ice-cold water, and looked up. I somehow squeaked out, "Actually, yeah, I have a girlfriend." "Well, what's her name?" "What's her name? Nice try, Colonel. You're just using the pride and ego-up approach to get her information." "Riley. Her name is Riley."
"How long have you been dating?"
6 months.
6 months?
He sounded a little shocked, not because it was a woman, apparently, but because I had been dating someone for 6 months and had yet to even hint at it. "Mm-hmm," I said, trying to stuff the rest of the chimichanga, the beans, and the entire platter of chips and guac into my mouth.
"Well, kiddo, you always had good female relationships."
He said it nonchalantly, like we were talking about my favorite color. Within 2 seconds, I was transported back to the Willy Wonka Tunnel of Terror. My dad's voice echoed in my head, "You always had good female relationships," as I glided further and further into my past. I saw the faces of all my friendships throughout the years, all the burned mixed tapes accompanied by handwritten letters about why "Fall for You" by Secondhand Serenade was our friendship song. All the times there was that one girl in school whom I'd spend every waking moment with. "Good morning, it's me again. I know we don't have plans, but I brought you breakfast." The many times I had kissed my best friend in high school because it was a dare, but then couldn't stop thinking about it as I watched the rain fall so gracefully against the window pane. I came to, drenched in sweat, as my dad was asking for the check. Female friendships. It was the final nail in the coffin of gaydom. I was in a trance as we walked out of the restaurant, got into his car, and drove back to campus. I have no memory of getting out of the car and walking into the building for rehearsal, but suddenly I was standing in the lobby of the theater building, alone. No one had returned from break yet, and it was just me, myself, and the faint sound of "Take me or leave me."
"Oh, and you're sharp, Maureen."
All of a sudden, I let out a huge laugh. I had accepted that I was gay. I mean, I was in a relationship, hello, but this was different. My dad had called out something that appeared to have been there all along. The thing was, he was right about my relationships. My bonds with females have been as strong as Rosie the Riveter's upraised fist throughout the years. These friendships were nuclear, man, like superhuman, like my superpower. It was like I was Luke Skywalker and had just realized that the Force had been inside me all along. What I wanted to know was, how the F did I not see the signs? Moving on to Phase 1, Rocket Power Realness. You're made from good loins. My grandfather, Bobby Rouse, 1991. Chapter 1, Grand Entrance. I agreed to be born. To an unborn child, the transformation into a literal baby is a heavy task. And not just because I was a heavy child at 8 pounds and 11 ounces. I'd like to consider myself a reasonable person, but I needed to know, if I were to leave my little chamber, that I'd have a say in how things went. A full head of hair, a sunny disposition, good lungs for screaming, etc. Listen, I like to be prepared. Sue me. Alas, I was an unborn child, and I didn't quite know how to tell my mom my terms of departure. So there I was, floating in the amniotic fluid, content with that being my home, but my mom had other plans. A week after missing her due date, I was still waiting for my demands to be accepted. My very preggers mom was in sheer agony and doing whatever she could to get me out of her. Despite her best efforts, all the spicy food in the world, raspberry sweet tea, squat jumping, and witchcraft chanting wouldn't work. Little did she know, I was in there sucking down all that jambalaya, the rhythmic chanting lulling me to sleep as I waited for our negotiation to be completed. My dad was stationed overseas in Germany and had sent my mom back to the States, to Biloxi, Mississippi, to be exact, so she could be with her parents, Bobby and Sally. Dad wanted to make sure I was born on American soil so that I could have the chance to become president. Very high expectations from the start. I'd like to officially state that, Dad, sorry to disappoint, I do not want to be president. Yet. However, Obama, if you're reading this, DM me. My mom was at her wit's end. She called my dad and told him that if I didn't arrive soon, and if he didn't arrive soon, she'd take it upon herself to figure out other ways to hurry me up. A few options being castor oil, a bumpy car ride, or hiring tiny men to jump up and down on her stomach like a trampoline. It was a standoff. As she was about to call in the Tiny Men Brigade, Dad managed to squeak into town, fresh flat top and all. His military airlift command flight landed, and Mom insisted they race to the hospital, only to discover I was still not ready. Her gynecologist told her that I was so far up, I was stuffed inside her esophagus, and that she and my dad should try having sex. That night, my mom, who was uncomfortably pregnant, stripped off all her clothes, stared at my dad, and asked, "You ready?" He responded, "Let's just get this over with." And what do you know? It worked. 2 days later, on the morning of May 18th, right before she was about to dig into Grandpa Bobby's famous biscuits and gravy, Mom yelled, "My water broke!" Dad jumped to his feet and said, "Attention!" Grandpa Bobby, a.k.a. Papa, drawled from the living room, "The pipes broke! Water! My water broke!" "Susan, we don't have time for this," Dad said. But he was no match for the Southern exchange. Mom entered the living room, holding her stomach. "Dad, my water broke!" "Oh, good Lord, crap! Sally, we gotta go to the hospital. Susan's water broke." Grandma Sally, who was in the process of curling her hair, shot back from the bathroom coolly. "You're out of your damn mind if you think I'm going to the hospital looking like this," and continued to methodically take out her rollers. Mom made herself a plate and sat down at the kitchen table with a bath towel in between her legs.
"I'm going to have my biscuits first, so y'all can meet me in the car in 5.
The four of them loaded into the Buick and finally rushed her to the hospital, bath towel and all, on the nearest military base, with the nurses saluting my dad as he wheeled my mom into her room. Still, I made everyone wait even longer. There was no way in hell, no matter how long my mother labored, more than 24 hours, that I was ready to make an appearance. Thus, I was born via emergency cesarean, brought about by my parents' sad sex. In my humble opinion, the term C-section doesn't do it justice. Cesarean sounds so elegant, regal even, and that is how I entered the world, theatrics and all. My full head of hair was very King Arthur suave. Thanks, Mom and Dad. So I just needed a tiny flower crown and sword, and I was ready to make my mark as Sophie Elizabeth Santos. Mom and Dad had planned to name me Ben Bob, after Dad and my Grandpa Bobby, but they got a girl. Thank God. If I'd been gifted a name like Ben Bob, I would have wanted to open a gator wrestling school. They also tossed around naming me Vanessa because I'd been conceived in a van on the beach. Ultimately, they settled on Sophie Elizabeth and called me by my middle name, with me not deciding which one I'd like to be called for years to come. I wish I could say it was all smooth sailing once I had raised my tiny fists into the air for the first time, but I was rushed to the baby ICU, with an IV stuck in my head that created a bald spot I have to this very day, and my mom fell ill, so the delivery room conversation turned quickly to, "Is Susan gonna die?" which was just lovely, as she has since said. Being an overachieving nurse herself, Mom eventually noticed that something was wrong with her chart. Every time they gave her medication for the presumed infection, her fever spiked. "It's called drug fever," she told the nurse taking care of her. "I don't understand." She grabbed the nurse by the neck and said they needed to get her off the meds stat. "Ma'am, well, if we do that, you might die." "I guess we'll find out," she said with total confidence. That night, she was released and ate at the officers' club on base, and I was bundled up and smiling at Mom, who had nursed herself back to health. The better late than never child. Not to mention, my parents had me in their mid-30s, which was not only late for their generation, but was somehow rude. My dad's parents arrived the next day and greeted me, while my Spanish grandma, Carmen, said, "Oh my God, how beautiful!" on repeat. My Filipino grandpa, Peepaw, kept pulling his son to the side to insist that I be raised Catholic. Grandpa Bobby nudged my mom and whispered, "You're made from good loins. She is, too." Grandma Sally, overhearing, snapped and said, "Enough of that, Bobby." I was the product of a Southern immigrant military family destined to be Sophie Santos-ish of the House of the Hard Head, one of a kind, queen of the stunted late bloomers, and certifiable smartass. 2 weeks later, we flew to Germany, and I became a European baby, but only for a year. If I had had any say about it, I would have kept us in Europe, baby. I loved being a European baby. I'd don my baby berets and eat my tiny schnitzels. Alas, I still couldn't communicate, so I didn't have a say in the family plans. I guess we were destined for Kansas, home of the wheat fields, as one of the many stops on our upcoming U.S. world tour. Unfortunately, as much as I wanted to keep calling the shots, I was no longer in charge, and my life was about to become a circus. Daycare, location Fort Riley, Kansas, Female Friendship, Kira. Favorite Time to Hang, Nap Time. Kira was the first of many female friendships I had growing up. I threw myself into at least one friendship like this every time my family moved. Most were fleeting, but each, at the time, was my very best friend. Kira and I were attached at the hip. I have often found myself attracted to shiny, pretty things, and Kira was the shiniest and prettiest thing at my daycare. She had the best Oshkosh B'gosh overalls, and her pink sparkle shoes were top-notch. We spent lunchtime, story time, and nap time practically on top of each other. My daycare teacher, Audrey, warned us several times to stop the nap time chit-chat. We'd close our eyes, pretend we were asleep, and then, moments later, pick up where we'd left off. An inane, unending discussion about Andrew, who we both agreed looked like a ginger-haired Cabbage Patch Kid and was possibly an actual doll. Eventually, Audrey got fed up with our antics and separated our cots. "You!" she said, pointing at me. It felt like a gunshot to my heart. "Over there!" She pointed to the opposite side of the classroom. "You!" she said, pointing at Kira. Another gunshot. "Don't move!" I looked across the room, which had instantly transformed into a desert wasteland, too far and too treacherous to traverse. I dragged my cot and furiously set it up on the other side of the room. And then I did the only thing I could think of. I threw a hissy fit. I wailed and wailed, pining over my lost love. Audrey must have been made of steel, because she didn't move a muscle. I waited for her to be distracted by another classmate who had just learned to climb and was apparently training for Everest. I dragged my cot back over to Kira's. "What are you doing? You're going to get us both killed," she whispered. "I don't care. I missed you too much." The noise from our muffled conversation must have gotten Audrey's attention, because I felt my sorry 5-year-old butt moving inches away from Kira. I looked up to see Audrey staring over my cot, dragging it, with my body splayed across it, even farther away. She stuck me by the trash can. I kicked the trash over in protest. When Audrey extended our punishment to a full week of separation, I cried more than I did when my mom dropped me off every morning, which is to say, a lot. We've run out of time for today's episode of That's Halaf. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please be sure to listen next time. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. That's Halaf is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other NCRS shows, please call us at 919-832-5138. Our number one more time is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.